Hello, Recursive Community, here live from Bucharest. Today, we're meeting one of the most prominent and prolific founders and investors on the Romanian tech scene. Radu Georgescu is a serial entrepreneur with over 30 years of experience in the tech industry.
I'm an old guy, man. I'm really old. Experience.
That's experience. That's
absolutely
not age. That's a different thing. He has successfully exited several companies, including the acquisition of the Rough antivirus technology by Microsoft, the e-payment business by Naspers, AvantGate by San Francisco Partners, and VectorWatch by Fitbit. Radu is currently the founder and the CEO of GCAD Ventures, a family office that invests in high-growth potential companies.
Absolutely.
He is also a board director and advisor to numerous technology companies, including the investment platform for tech startups Seedblink. Radu Georgescu, welcome to the Recursive Podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's amazing.
I've been looking forward to this conversation for a long time. I think I myself, as a founder and a CEO, I think I have a lot to learn. So I'm going to use the time.
Don't oversell. I'm going to be embarrassed. But it's long overdue. I take it. Yeah.
So we will have now probably around an hour, which I'm going to have you just for myself. You won't, you know, be looking at your phone. We won't be distracted.
No way.
I love this setting of the podcast where we kind of like get back to the normal way of, you know, communicating.
Yep.
And in the beginning, I always bring you back to the beginning. And for me, this starts with your diploma project. Mm-hmm. Where you basically got first the taste of being an entrepreneur. What is it like to be an entrepreneur?
Funny enough, it goes a little beyond that. So back in high, as I was saying, I'm kind of, you know, I'm 55, as we're speaking now, and there's a lot of history going back, right? So back in my high school, I realized that, I'm coming from a normal family, you know, mother and father engineers and everything. So not poor, not rich, right? Mm. And it was during Ceausescu's time, and during high school, I was like every other kid, you know, need to get, you know, some money for a beer or for whatever were needed. And what I was doing, because I was kind of skilled technically, I was doing the projects for my colleagues, right? So their project homework, you know, on mechanisms and you know, drawings and stuff, right? So my first entrepreneurial, if you want to say it, is making the homework, and I know it's completely not the right thing to do or say whatever, but that's kind of brought me into the idea that, you know, selling services and making some money by working. And working, it's something good, and it gave me a lot of understanding who the customer is and what means to work for money and the ethics of working and doing the right things, right? And then when the college ended in the last year, that was back in 92, I got suddenly out of nowhere in a laboratory with computers. And when I'm saying computers, don't think laptops or, you know, even PCs or whatever, big mainframes, whatever, M16, like, you know, big green screens with letters, that thing.
What was the first programming language that you actually used?
I used Lisp.
Lisp.
Lisp. That was at that time, Lisp and Fortran.
Yeah.
So what I realized at that time, that was a love at first sight with computer and epiphany for me, was that whereas what I was doing was take a project from a colleague, you know, work 2 hours, earn, you know, 10 bucks, 2 more hours, 10 bucks, 2 more hours, 10 bucks, a very linear growth, you know, which is my selling minutes type of a thing.
Yeah.
If you use a computer and you develop a software, you invest in the software and you go into a J curve, you invest in a software, you spend, you know, the first 2 days by not earning anything. But then it's like insert data, print, insert data, print, insert data, print. And that growth exponentially. So that exponential growth of a business was something that actually struck into my mind so solid and so transformational for me as a kid at that time, that I was like, man, I need to do this for a living. I need to be able to work, to earn not out of minutes, which is very linear and non-scalable. I mean, you only have...
The service business.
Absolutely. Okay. You only have that many minutes, right?
Yeah.
in a day. And need to actually invest in... I didn't know at that time that was intellectual property or software. It was very early days. And then get to be able to sell it without doing anything. Right? And that was transformational and absolutely amazing.
Yeah, but I guess for that, you need a certain type of mindset. I'm wondering, do you think that the entrepreneurial mindset is something that you're born with, or is it something that you can develop over time?
I think that they're both, you know, nature and nurture, like everything. The nature thing, the things we are born with, I think that is the risk taking. Mm-hmm. And I think people are born with a capacity to take only so much risk. Mm-hmm. And if you are unable to swallow the risk of, you know, not being able to make it to the next month, or if the company is going bazookas, because no, very, very small percentage of companies are successful. That's what we're seeing. But there are so many companies that are failing for every one success. So if you are not able to take the question, am I going to be able to bring a salary at the end of the month for my family? Mm-hmm. Which is a very tough question, right? It is. It is. Then I think it's being employed is the perfect thing to be, and trying to be an entrepreneur when this risk is actually killing you from the inside, I think that that's the worst thing that you can do. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, people that are more able to go to sleep when they know that, you know, let's sleep today and tomorrow we find a solution, mm-hmm. right? Are better suited to become entrepreneurs. Everything else can be learned. So that I think that's the very engraved that we're born with. Okay. But everything else, I think, can actually be trained.
Okay. I don't think that I was nurtured or born with the you know, risk embracing part of me. But over time, I was actually, you know, working on that. And when you go through challenges, when you go through disasters and tragedies, at some point you realize, huh, I survived back then. Probably I will survive this time. You know, back then I thought the world is going to end. It didn't. Maybe it won't end this time as well. So I think it is also experience. I mean, when you go through a couple of several, you know, of challenges, then at some point you just become more thick-skinned and you're much more confident in life. That's
absolutely
the end. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay. Interesting. But you know, what I find fascinating is that you did that in the context of the 90s where...
92,
which I can imagine were very economically challenging years for Romania. So I don't think that anyone was feeling safe financially, even if you had like the best diploma, if you are, you know, an academic or an engineer. At least in Bulgaria, we would have, you know, engineers who would be taxi drivers, or they would be selling flowers on the market because they just couldn't find a job. So I think it's amazing that you managed to feel rather safe and sleep at night in these type of, you know,
I think it was at that time a combination. It is very hard to kind of go back on that mindset, all of us, and remember what was like back in 92. But I was very lucky to have the, you know, the bigger family around me. As I was saying, you know, we're living in the same house, mother and father, engineers, you know, in their primes. So decent money. My wife was a medical doctor. I mean, early she was just graduating, but she was bringing some money in the household. We wouldn't die of hunger,
yeah.
Right? And then after that, I for 1 year I was also employed and going for work as an employed in the mornings and do programming and entrepreneurial stuff in the evening for my own company.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, I think it was way harder to figure out at that time what a company means,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
actually,
mm-hmm.
Which today is like a no-brainer. I mean, yeah, you create a company, duh. But at that time, it was way harder to understand what a company means, what a contract means, and, you know, that type of a thing. I remember that, I think Bulgaria was the same at that time, before the revolution. In Romania, there is nothing private, right? There is no private economy, right? Sure. Everything was state-owned. So there was one car company, one bicycle company, one bread company. Even the cobbler, for God's sake, was one cobbler kind of institution. Therefore, there is no need for the sales or for the marketing skills.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to understand, you know, KPIs for a company, how to sell, how to market a product. And at the end of the day, you create a bicycle that has two wheels and, you know, it kind of goes. That's good enough. I mean, that's the only thing that people can buy. It's going to sell,
yes.
Right? Don't need to make it better. You don't need to make it red or yellow or green. You don't need to make it bigger or smaller to figure out what the customers want. Right? So all these skills were completely not understood, completely unavailable. So it was a learning process, absolutely amazing. And I enjoyed every moment of it. I had no clue what am I learning,
mm-hmm.
how am I doing it, but I enjoyed every step of it. And I felt into my nose like 1,000 times, and I'm full of bruises, of all the failures that they're saying, 37 companies, 6 of them successful,
yeah.
And maybe 10 of them didn't really lose all the money. The rest of them are amazing experience, and I cherish them, each and every one.
Hmm. Okay, so chronologically, the first exit that you had was of your diploma project.
Yes.
And then in 1994, you began developing the Rough antivirus.
Together with three others that ended
co-founders.
Up being failures. No, together with three other projects.
Three other, wow.
Yeah. that were, the other three were failures, ended up being failures.
So you were parallelly co-founder of 4 businesses at this time in the 90s, yeah?
Yeah, one in 92 and another 4 in 94. And let's speak a little bit about the failures of the 94, the three of them, because that's very interesting. And yeah. There's a lot of lessons and learning from failures. It's amazing. It's one of the better ways to learn.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the companies that we started at that time, and it's not only me. I mean, we were co-founders and a group of people that I cherish today, and people that are so good in what they were doing. And they're now all over the place in Microsoft, in Google, and so on. So in 94, we realized that one of the better sold programs was Norton Commander.
Oh, I remember it.
Remember, you know, the black screen with two windows. I mean, the computer was opening, turning on with Norton Commander. And that was the file thing.
True.
I was just saying that, you know, one of the failures that we started back in 1994, actually, was we realized that Norton Commander, remember Norton Commander, mm-hmm. at that time, you know, the blue screens and everything. It was on every computer, so it was obviously the best sold software ever. And I had no clue at that time. We had no clue as a team, you know, to sell internationally and this type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But we kind of imagined that, you know, if we can create a Norton command, if we can copy, because that was the mindset. I mean, somebody else created, why not copy it, right? Can copy Norton Commander, but make it cheaper. And the best programmer in Romania was like $100 at that time per month. And in Silicon Valley was whatever it was. So they're selling it $29. We're selling it $9. We're going to be rich. Mm-hmm. Right? So amazing. And we developed the software. We created, you know, perfect copycat of Norton Commander. And then 95 came. And what came in 95, right? Windows 95. Sure. Which was a complete killer for Norton Commander because it came with Windows Explorer, with File Explorer.
Yeah.
And I mean, Norton Commander got killed. A copycat was not even breathing, no yeah. chance, right? So what I learned then, and I learned it the very hard way, and it was very interesting, is that, man, you know, you need to understand the market and understand the future and the dynamics and figure out, you know, okay, you're creating this, it's going to take you 1 year, where everybody's going to be next year. And it was a very interesting thing that I'm actually still looking and applying these days. So amazing experiences.
That's very interesting, actually, what you're saying, because I think in these years, especially in the 90s, there were a lot of revolutionary technologies coming on the market, yeah. which were actually very transformational. So you've been through the dot-com bubble,
yeah.
The rise of social media in the meanwhile, yep. then later on, blockchain, crypto, you know, now the age of AI.
I was actually really involved in the blockchain technology and everything. So, okay. yeah. Well, one of the companies was a blockchain technology trying to develop, you know, smart contracts and everything, and that was back in 2012.
Wow. But how do you get a sense of where the market will be going so that you can basically build a company that is going to be resilient and robust through the, you know, whole transformation that is happening? How do you read something? How do you make these predictions?
You have to make predictions, and we're all making our own predictions. You are doing predictions for your business, what's going to happen. Sure. I'm doing for my businesses, you know, my colleagues are doing as well. And either you are really, and for this, we're all learning and listening to podcasts and to smarter people kind of speaking and reading books and everything, trying to make our best guess of what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And obviously, statistically, sometimes we fail, sometimes we make it right. Mm-hmm. My theory is that statistics makes the difference. Okay. And portfolios are making the difference. So now I'm speaking on behalf of the investors, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, investing in one company is like a lottery ticket.
True.
And you are making, it's a little better than a lottery ticket because you have some understanding of the market and understanding of the team and, you know, a little bit there, but it's like a lottery ticket. Whereas if you develop a portfolio and you are getting into statistics, then you are in a completely different ball game.
But as a founder, you don't really have this perspective. I mean, as a founder, True. You're pretty much like with this tunnel vision, and you have to be like that so that you can...
Yes, yes. Having said this, mm-hmm. pivoting,
yeah.
It's one of the most important tools that a founder has,
okay.
right? Because you start with the assumption and you can either put your head down and, you know, start digging on your plan. Mm. And they all say that, you know, you have to have a plan. Mm. If you don't have a plan, you know, you are dead. Mm. And I agree, you have to have a plan, but the plan can change every day,
yes.
right? The worst is not to have a plan. But so two ways, one in my mind, one is to put your head down and go all the way for 4 years, ignore completely what's happening around you and create, you know, the dream software or car or whatever you are building, mm-hmm. and then show it to the market. And then meanwhile, the market has changed. Mm-hmm. Or start actually, you know, building. And we're going to come back between selling and building what's first, you know, the American and German models.
Yeah.
But you can start building. And always keep your hands up and look around and see whenever you realize that whatever you're doing doesn't necessarily go in the market in the same direction as the market. Mm-hmm. Just pivot. Just acknowledge that you were going in a direction which is not perfect. You realize that there is another direction which is now it seems perfect. Just pivot and figure out where the market goes as you roll.
So you mean that, you know, the agility and the flexibility is much more important for an entrepreneur in a ever-changing environment than, you know, being, you know, really focused on building the perfect product?
I would never dare to give advice.
Okay.
I'm only speaking for myself.
Okay.
And I do believe that agility for me was so much more important. But I do have friends that were so stuck in their vision that at the end of the day, 20 years later, that they actually made it.
I see.
Going through, you know, everything, all the pains and everything. And because they're so stuck, they actually made it. And, you know, that's great as well. I mean, there's a lot of value into being persistent into your own vision.
We're going to get into that. But I wonder also, what are your sources? How do you get informed? Because I think for us right now, because there is such an abundance of content out there, it's very difficult to make our selection of what is relevant.
Yeah.
So how do you get informed nowadays? What do you read? What do you listen to? Maybe you can share your sources with the others.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to give you probably the most unexpected response here. The most important thing for me to understand what's happening in the world is traveling to Silicon Valley.
Okay.
So yeah, it's a digital world. We have access to all the tools. You can actually see the same podcasts from your hotel room in the Bay Area and from your own bedroom. Yeah.
In Bucharest.
And it's not the same.
Okay.
It's not the same. To give you one more example, so I've been 2 months ago in the Bay Area, called friends there to meet, and half of them we met over Zoom, right?
Yes.
So I was there next door, and we met over Zoom. Could we have met from here over Zoom? Yes. Every time I'm writing people, oh, you know, I remember that, you know, let's catch up.
Yeah.
If I'm here in Bucharest, okay, we will whenever. Let's find the time, and sometimes doesn't happen. If I'm telling them I'm here in the Bay Area, let's meet, we are going to meet. Mm. So it is so important to be there, and I'm going to be a little bit romantic or whatever you want to call it, but breathe the same air and be in that community, meet with that people. They think different. And I'm not saying Silicon Valley is the perfect world. It's not perfect by no means, right? But there is a little bit of something for this industry we are in together. Mm-hmm. There is a little bit something that makes you think different.
So it's not about the information that you're consuming, but it's more like you're getting their way of thinking when you're there. You get infected by it.
It's more that.
Yeah.
It includes information because you figure out what they are, because, you know, speaking, you know, for lunches, dinners, coffees, meetings, whatever, you figure out how they think, who they meet with, what they are reading, what they are listening, what are the latest, you know, things and, you know, the nice companies and the gems that are not in the papers and so on. So for me, that's the most important thing. So if I was an entrepreneur, so that's what I'm doing as an entrepreneur, the most important thing for me from this perspective is to jump in a plane, get there and spend time and make friends in the Bay Area.
That's amazing. I wasn't aware of that. But a friend of mine pointed out recently, I was complaining to him that, you know, as a as a CEO, I don't really have the time to read all the things that I want to read and to listen to all the podcasts that I want to listen to. It's like, I mean, who has the time to listen to a 3-hour podcast? I don't have it anymore. And over the years, I started feeling like I'm getting dumb. Because it's like
drinking for the fire hose.
Exactly.
You cannot actually.
And then he said, but you shouldn't be underestimating how much you learn from people, you know, just by talking to them. And I said, yeah, that's actually true, you know?
Yep.
Because that's what I do for a living now. I'm basically meeting with people and talking to them and, you know, creating new friendships and getting inspired by their stories.
Yep.
I guess you can train your brain also just by being social.
Yeah, internet is like a fire hose. You're drinking water from a fire hose. It's like you're gonna get dead of thirst because you cannot drink water from a fire hose.
Yeah.
Same with internet. You're never gonna be able to watch or listen so many podcasts and get the actual information from there. Mm. So I kind of stopped doing this. I'm probably listening 2 or 3 podcasts a week, and
that's
it.
Saying that, it's making me feel less bad myself.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, amazing.
But then you have to replace this with some sort of a communication and some sort of an informal training and learning process.
Mm. So I'm going to repeat that because I think it's still amazing. You started as a co-founder of 37 companies.
Yes.
I mean, that number is just amazing. So you've been very prolific. And from what I hear, you started several ventures sometimes at the same time. Which part of creating a product or, you know, bringing it to the market, turning into a successful business, exiting it, which part of this stages of, you know, running a business do you enjoy the most?
Yeah, so that's the most interesting thing and the most exciting thing. So, look, imagine that, I mean, the very beginning is the short answer, but the way it works is like you're on your balcony, right, with a friend. It's late night, you know, a couple of beers, you know, you're just sitting on the beer case and just speaking about whatever you can speak at 2 o'clock in the night, right? And, you know, there's some sort of a crazy idea that comes to mind. And, you know, because of the night and the beer and this and that, it seems like a great idea. And sometimes tomorrow you're thinking, oh, you were speaking about something either you don't remember or you realize how dumb an idea it was. But sometimes, you know, it seems to be like, oh, you know, why not?
Okay.
Yeah. And yeah, let's meet tomorrow again and let's meet and let's see what the hell we were speaking about.
Mm-hmm.
And if that is not that dumb as it could have been, you write, you know, a one pager business plan or whatever you want
a
to
napkin.
Call it. Yeah, napkin. Yeah, exactly. So it's so exciting because out of nothing, a couple of beers, you know, 2 guys in a balcony, 1 week later, you have a business plan. So
wow.
there's something, right? And then if that doesn't make sense, you just
throw it away.
But if kind of potentially is not that stupid, then you start developing. I mean, in software, you can, I mean, between 2 guys, I mean, you can start programming. And 1 month later, you have an MVP, you have a product, right? So that is such an amazing thing. I mean, you know, 2 guys, a couple of beers in the balcony, you know, 1 week later you have a business plan, 1 month later you have a product, and then you just realize that, you know, the MVP is done, you have to have some users and you put it online or whatever it is, the app, the product, you put it online and it's not perfect and everything, but there is a download or create user or whatever button there for people to use it. And then you go in the back office and in your dashboards and see, oh, nobody's doing this. You're starting calling your friends, you know, can you please create a user and tell me? And you realize the first user created. So the first user created, and then the first user that's not your friend, the first user that you don't know who the hell she or he is. So that's such an amazing and empowering thing. So, you know, a couple of beers, you know, 2 friends in the balcony, you know, a business plan, a an MVP and the first user. So the first user, even now when I'm speaking, you know, I'm getting goosebumps. So the first user that is actually using, I have all the tools to actually see that user. Oh, he went here, he went here, he's using this. Oh, that's bad. He's sending emails that, you know, it's so bad, the product, and it's great. I mean, the bad product to start with is great, right? And then you're doing this and you're doing and you're doing, you're getting one more friend that's working overnight because, you know, he's a student morning in the university, mm-hmm. in the afternoon he's going to work, and then overnight he's helping you with that. Mm-hmm. And at some point in time, you put the magic button there, pay now, or, you know, mm-hmm. you know, apply for whatever plan and everything, right? And again, you go back to the to your dashboard and everything, and you try to figure out, so new user, is he gonna pay? He's not gonna pay. And when somebody's paying, it's such an amazing feeling. Somebody, it's giving you money for the product that you've created with your own hands, right? So couple of beers, couple of friends in the balcony, mm-hmm. you know, business plan, product, first user, first money that somebody actually paid to reward your work.
Wow.
And ideas. And that's so amazing. And then you start building on it and everything, and then you get to break even, and then it's not interesting anymore.
There the story ends. So now I understand why 37.
There you go.
So I guess you were kind of like, looking for these first successes, the little successes.
But that's where most of the value.
That's drug.
that's where the most of the value is being created, right? Yeah. Because you create value from nothing to something, which is infinite, right?
True.
Exactly.
Yeah, then it goes a bit.
And then you get into once you are break even, you are growing 20% per year.
What about the first exit? I mean, weren't you ecstatic about it?
Yeah, absolutely, I was. Absolutely, for so many reasons.
Yeah.
But
it was the first user paying for your work that made you more excited, I guess.
Absolutely. So exits are ecstatic from whatever I'm doing right now, which is taking care of everything above the CEO, the board of directors, the shareholding, the M&A activity and so on. And it's great that you are putting the company into the hands of somebody better than you, that can take care of the company better for the future and the product.
That's something that you mentioned in our conversation just before we started. You said, I'm actually a bad CEO.
I am.
But you see yourself more as a strategist.
Yeah.
So, tell me a bit more about, the traits that kind of made you successful, but also about the blind spots. Like, what I really liked about your conversation is that you're very honest about the things that you're not good at, that you suck at. And I think for an entrepreneur, it's also very important just to know yourself. Where are your strengths? Where are your weaknesses? And then, okay, where my weaknesses are, I'm going to hire people for that. So tell me about this. How did you reflect about your personality over the years by creating 37 companies?
I'm a very introspect person.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to be honest with myself.
Okay.
And both with myself and in companies, I'm trying to figure out what the weaknesses are and what the strengths are.
Okay.
And figure out a strategy either to go to improve the weaknesses,
mm-hmm.
or to hide the weaknesses or solve them somehow else and actually improve work for the strengths, right?
Okay.
For me personally, I'm trying to increase and work and develop the strength and become the best where my strengths are,
mm-hmm.
and figure out friends and colleagues and teamwork and everything to kind of figure out how to not touch the weaknesses,
mm-hmm.
and that therefore I would be a very bad strategist for real estate, just giving an example, or for restaurant management. Could I learn it? Probably. I'm not that stupid. I could learn it, but I would suck at it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Very bad executive person. Very bad CEO. I cannot actually really figure out who's the best person, the best hire for one position or the other position.
But that's surprising because you seem very social. I mean, you seem very extrovert, which should be
right.
Giving you, you know, the sight to see who are the good people. Why do you believe that you suck at it? Did you have many bad hires?
I've never been a CEO in my life.
Okay.
And I'm 100% sure that I would be very bad on managing. I mean, I suck at managing my own house. My wife is actually managing everything. And look, I'm married for 36, 37 years, whatever it is.
So you keep the years of marriage like the number of you know, ventures that you're creating.
Yeah. got married in 89, so whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
She's the one managing things. I'm very good on strategy, mm-hmm. but I cannot manage things.
What about sales and marketing? Because you mentioned that before, that it's you know, a knowledge that we don't have a long tradition in having it in Eastern Europe. I mean, back then there was a monopoly for most of the products, let's say, and services that were out there. So I think we're now in the period where we are like reinventing sales and marketing in some ways. But
I think there's been quite a long time, and there's a lot of, you know, Microsofts and Oracles and, you know, big companies, as well as, you know, local companies going outside. Mm-hmm. So the knowledge is there now, okay. and a lot of great, you know, salespeople and market people are around.
Mm-hmm.
In the last 10 years, maybe product people came into the region. There was a lack of product design mm-hmm. people. And product design and product management, it's a universe that was completely unencompassed around here. Absolutely. So I think there are more and more really good people around to work with and to join them as a co-founder and either, you know, helping each other as a team. From the product, from the technology, from the sales, marketing, you know, financial, to the, you know, general management, to the strategy, vision, managing the investors, and managing, you know, the bigger road of the company, which includes good product and revenues, but it includes as well financing mm-hmm. and where the company goes in the next, you know, 10 years. And understanding whether this company is designed to create profits and pay dividends to the investors, or is it a high growth company? Mm-hmm. Is it a top line company? Like, you know, are you measuring users or revenues, or is it a bottom line company? Are you measuring revenues, mm-hmm. profitability, or is this what are the key components of the company, and how are those components and KPIs of the company translate in the perception of investors, acquirers, customers to the company? How's the balance sheet mm-hmm. of the company not only changes your taxes, but actually brings you customers, or does not deter customers that want a specific type of a balance sheet.
Mm-hmm.
So a company needs a great product,
mm-hmm.
needs great execution, but it needs amazing business execution on the vision.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
It is. I think for most startup founders, it's very clear that they're supposed to do the execution as well. And not all of us are good at that. but it's like an unwritten law somewhere. And then we spent maybe years trying to figure out, you know, how to do that. Where I find it interesting, and I've met a couple of startup founders who said at some point, but actually I'm not the CEO type of person, and you know, I'm going to find someone else and I'm going to hire for that. Or maybe they would become a lead co-founder or whatever.
Absolutely. But, you know, the CEO has to be a lead co-founder.
I'm abdicating. You know, my role in the company will be totally different. And I'm thinking that at the same time, this transition can be also very difficult because the business is still your baby.
I think that the business is not your baby.
How do you let go of the control? Was it difficult for you?
You put it in the hands of somebody better. Mm. It's not. So I think that the mindset is like, you know, if you want to get with this metaphor with a baby, mm-hmm. which I don't necessarily agree, but you know, the baby grows, and you know, you have to let it fly and put it in the hands of somebody that can give that now adult, you know, something that you are not able to give him or her as a parent. Mm-hmm. Right, and same with the company. And if you look at the big companies, the small companies of the world, whatever it is, you see that the company needs different type of CEOs mm-hmm. as they grow. Mm-hmm. Right, they have a technologies. Look at whatever the telecom companies in this part of the world, and mm-hmm. I know the Romanian ones, I'm sure that you have the same in Bulgaria because they came with knowledge, with this type of knowledge.
It's difficult to keep track of all the...
Of the CEOs. So,
they get acquired.
You first have, you know, the technical type of a CEO mm-hmm. that focuses into, you know, for telecom, like creating the infrastructure, for software, you know, building the software and so on. Then you have the sales type of CEO that actually creates the revenues, the users, sales or marketing, you know, the top line type of a CEO. Yeah. Then you have the financial type of a CEO that actually goes and creates the bottom line and everything. So for different moments, different types of companies, you need different types of CEOs. Mm. And it's absolutely impossible that, you know, unless you are Elon Musk or, you know, that kind of...
Well, we see that not even him is good at everything, so...
at least he imagines. So, you know, you're good on all stages of the company. Mm-hmm. Statistically, it's more probable that you are not good at all, mm-hmm. right? So, you figure out what you are good at. And it's not easy, but you figure out what you are good at, and then you get partners... To help with the rest.
How did you figure out what you're good at? Like, did you do some kind of personality assessment? Did you go to a shrink? Or how did you know what you're good at?
I have no clue. Yeah. I have no clue. I don't even... I think it was more instinctive. Okay. I don't know. And look, I was young. I didn't know what I was doing at that time. I've been through a lot of luck. Mm. Luck is important in life. Actually, my resume, my, you know, CV, I have three professional skills. One of them is luck.
I see.
I mean, written on paper.
I love that.
Yeah.
Well, statistically speaking, when you look at the business success of many people, you come to the conclusion that, of course, there are many factors that, you know, can help you, but the most important one is actually no luck.
Yeah.
Because you cannot control the timing. Tell me about ego. How important is ego for an entrepreneur? And what kind of ego do you need to have, you know, to be successful?
I think, and again, I may be completely wrong, but yeah.
From your perspective, of course.
I think a healthy level of ego is important that keeps you focused on winning. Mm. So because you want to win for different reasons, now ego is one of them. So a healthy level of ego, I think it's important. Too much ego is obvious, like anything that's too much, it's probably bad. Mm.
I wonder how did your perspective change now that you're on the side of the investor? Before that, you were, you know, the entrepreneur building products and, you know, bringing them to the market. now you are the CEO of Chica Adventures, your family office, you're investing in companies.
I'm not even the CEO of that company.
I'm sorry. Yeah, you told me. I've never been a CEO in my life. So, but you do invest in companies. You're also a mentor. You're also on the board of Seedblink. So your perspective has totally changed. Now you're not, you know, operationally involved in building the companies, but you have to judge.
I've never been.
Yeah.
It's hard to get it, but I've never been operationally involved in companies. Companies that I founded, companies that I started, I've never been operationally involved in them.
Okay.
I understand it's unusual. I get investors, I get VCs completely puzzled.
Mm-hmm.
But I was never involved. I'm a co-founder of Seedblink as well, and I took over as a mentor for one of the up and coming products, Nimity. Mm-hmm. So it's a product that's kind of thought the vision and, you know, the idea by me, but there's a proper professional team that is actually doing the things.
Okay. So your role would be rather to identify the market niche, the problem that needs to be solved.
I think that not being involved in execution keeps me far away. So it gives me the ability to see it from afar, and therefore not to be in the forest and not to be kind of stuck in the day-to-day problems, and be able to speak with people and use my network to actually understand what's there and come with all the information and deliver it to the team that is better prepared to actually create.
Okay, to build the product. Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. And still, I think at the stage where you're investing as an investor, you pretty much need to, you know, bet on the team. So you need to have a good judgment of, does this team have what it's needed, what is necessary to be successful and to make the most of my money, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, so what traits are you looking at in a founding team?
Yeah, so for an investment, let me step back a little bit. So I think that 20 years ago, the most important thing in a company was technology. So technology was at high demand, you know. He or she who had the technology was king, right? Then technology became commodity. I think today execution is the most important thing. So I believe that, you know, technology you can buy from anywhere. I think that, and that's no respect for my, you know, technology creator colleagues, but, you know, at the end of the day, technology is not as important as it used to be 20 years ago. The business execution, though, is something that it's the most important. And remember, so Google was not the first search engine, right? Mm-hmm. And it was not technology that made them different, but the execution. Facebook was not the first social network. Mm-hmm. Microsoft was not the first operating system, and so on, right? So basically, flawless execution of the business, I think it's the most important thing. Now, with this, when investing, I believe that, you know, there's obviously has to be a damn good vision that fits, you know, the market and everything, all the good stuff there. There has to be good chemistry and, you know, the same values with the team and with the founders and stuff. But it does have to have flawless execution abilities. Now, that means that it's not a founder, it's a founding team.
Okay.
Because, you know, there are so many roles in the company, depending what stage the company is, there are less roles needed for the stage or more, if the stage is kind of later. And you need to have to see in the team multiple roles that are that the team is able to execute. And is a person able to execute two or three roles together? Yeah, why not? But not all of them. Mm-hmm. And you're thinking, you know, technology, you know, sales, marketing, product, mm-hmm. Financial people. I mean, there are so many. And you need to see a team, or at least I need to see a team that understand, you know, the ensemble and is able to flawlessly execute on all the business needs of the company.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It's an interesting perspective. And because you mentioned that you're also one of the co-founders of SeedBlink, where it's a very mixed role. So you're at the same time on the side of the investor, but also on the side of someone who is responsible for the strategy, for the vision in a way. What is the vision of SeedBlink?
Thank you for this question. So how much time do you have? Now, there is obviously a very short answer, which is a stock exchange-like stack for smaller technology companies in Europe, across Europe, right? Okay. There is a longer answer. And the longer answer is that, look, we have two asset classes. One is money, one is shares, equity, mm-hmm. right? Both of them are the same thing. They're a piece of paper with a perceived value, mm-hmm. right?
So, sure.
Yeah. Now, SeedBlink is in the business of moderating between the two of them.
Okay.
So moderate between the two of them, you need two things. You need a relative value between money and shares, mm-hmm. and an exchange process, mm-hmm. right? Now, the relative value is the company value divided by the cap table, by the number of shares.
Mm-hmm.
And the exchange process between shares and money is either primaries, when the money goes in the company, or secondaries, when, you know, two shareholders are changing, right? So you have the valuation of the company, you have the cap table management, you have the primaries, you have the secondaries.
Yeah.
Now, the full stack is being solved for mature companies by stock exchange.
True.
For smaller companies, there is no full stack. There are solutions for each and every pieces, but there is no full stack solution. In the US, companies like Carta, for example, mm-hmm. Started by doing, you know, the cap table management and then expanded slowly. In Europe, there's nothing that I know of that goes into this direction.
Mm-hmm.
We started the other way around. We created the primaries, which is SeedBlink as we know it, for the last 2 years. And that's a pan-European company that helps technology companies across Europe. We do have offices in Romania, Bulgaria, Greece, Austria. We acquired Simbid in Netherlands. So it's really pan-European, helping companies to get primary investment when they are young, technology yeah. companies across Europe, and helping also investors, angel investors, you know, small VCs to invest, to find and get a seat at the table to invest in great companies.
Mm-hmm. Right?
That's primaries. We launched in January this year the secondaries market. So now people can actually trade mm-hmm. shares.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a huge step. And
it's a
very, very important step ahead. And now we just launched it in Barcelona 1 week ago, the beta of Nimity, Nimity.com, which is the cap table management tool that comes into this vision,
mm-hmm.
which is basically you as a company are actually keeping all your cap table into Nimity, and your shareholders can see their ownership and everything, and you can actually manage your ESOP, which is amazingly important because
True.
Companies are happy to give away ESOP, but you know they don't have tools to actually explain the employees, you know, how much do they have, what can they do with the ESOP, you know, implement secondaries so they can sell their options or their shares, and you know, recycle the ESOP and all this knowledge about the ESOP that's all built in, and all the documentation of the shareholders and there. So taking care of the cap table, you know, completely on the like really solid, that's something that I didn't see in this part of the world in any case, and it's absolutely amazing. And suddenly we are, you know, we're not a stock exchange because technically we are not auctioning and we're not market creators, but we are a stock exchange like because we do have all those features that I was saying. And that's transformational for European investment environment. That's absolutely transformational. And it's exciting, you know, speaking again about goosebumps and everything. It's amazing to think and to actually believe and work towards transforming a specific industry. This industry is kind of doomed to be transformed because it's a 50 years old industry. It has to change. Mm-hmm. That's what we are doing, and it's exciting. It's an amazing journey. Great company, great co-founders to work with. Great team. I can speak for 2 days about Sibling. I'm that excited.
But I guess if you weren't exciting, you wouldn't be doing that because you're now at a stage in your life where, I mean, you probably don't need to work at all. Why aren't you on the beach somewhere, you know?
Oh, come on. No.
Relaxing and, you know, put your all your money in real estate and just, you know,
yeah, no.
Live
what, from... What's the fun? I mean, look. I know
tell me, what's the fun?
I can tell you again, you know, two bottle of beer, you know, two friends, balcony, business plan, product, first customer.
Okay.
Right. So, I mean, that's what the excitement is.
So that's your drug, basically.
Yeah.
With a
better connotation of the word, I guess so. Yeah.
That's cool.
I don't think I would be able to just lay back and... I mean, just wait for the time to grow.
Mm. Do you think of, you know, the moment where, you know, you look at back...
You have the opportunity to change the world, and we can change the world, each of us, with every step that we are doing, with every company that we are helping, with every idea that we are implementing. We have the opportunity to change the world. And then what? You know, to go and sit on an island and drink some Campari or whatever you are drinking, or beer or vodka or whatever. I mean, how would anybody actually prefer the island thing when you can actually do something that is so amazing?
I guess many people are, you know, dreaming exactly of that. I can't say, you know, I'm...
Would you?
I'm right now just stuck in the forest, in a way, also to see where I'm actually sometimes personally going to. But that's why I want to ask you, you know, you've been through this process. You're again, you know, building something that is transformational. So do you think of the moment where, I don't know, sometime, you know, way ahead in the future, you look back at the contribution and the change that you had on the world? What do you want to see there? You know, what you've brought to the world. I mean, you obviously have a family, and you also mentioned that you're a grandfather now.
Yeah, absolutely. And
which
so
is
excited.
A great contribution as well.
Absolutely.
37 companies, you know. Now.
So that's a very tough question. And I asked myself, I was telling you that I'm pretty introspect, and I asked myself quite a long time ago, you know, the obvious question, you know, what do you want to be written on your tombstone, right? And, you know, funny enough, I want to be written there that I was a happy person. So, and the moment I realized that, I was, first reaction was, oh, that's too egoistic, right? Second is, okay, I want to be happy, but, you know, that's the vision, you know, up there. And that based on, you know, health, family, professional, ethics, And a lot of things. I mean, there are so many pillars to that. But the moment the moment you can answer honestly, I mean, it has to be a very honest answer. The moment you answer honestly to that question, what do you want to be all right, things right. ending, yeah. right? It gives you what the vision is. I mean, you don't have an answer to a question, you go back to, you know, to the top vision, and that's going to give you the answer. And you know what? since the moment I realized that I am a happy person and I'm doing things that makes me happy and working in great companies with great teams is what makes me happy. Being in an island, it wouldn't make me happy. It's that easy. I mean, it's that easy.
Thank you for this answer. We have to wrap it up.
Right.
Actually, I like the ending because, you know, that's a question that right now is doing stuff in my head.
Okay. I love it.
Yeah, I had some insights the past weekend, so I've been thinking a lot about exactly this question. So
it's a tough question.
It is a tough one, but I love your perspective. And I love the fact that since you actually realized that in the end, you just want to, you know, be remembered as someone who was happy and also be happy that, you know, you're now happier
yourself. Yeah.
That it's, you know, it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy in a way.
Yep.
Rado, it's been a pleasure having you here. Thank you for this conversation and also sharing your wisdom. I like the, in a way, you know, you have this uniqueness because you're one of the, I would say, few founders that I know, who are very extroverted and, you know, very social. And then you say, okay, actually, you know, synergize with other people. And then, you know, the ideas for the next venture come out and I'm out there, not in the woods. I'm actually out there talking to people. And then I'm bringing this knowledge from the market basically in the company so that they can build it. I think that's a quality that's been hugely underestimated in our startup world.
Thanks so much for having me. It's amazing. I love speaking with you. And I was thinking sometime that we reverse roles and ask you some questions for an interview. I think you'd have a lot of answers to give and a lot of perspectives to give. And, you know, I'd strongly recommend that you come in this chair at some point in time and get somebody else to ask you questions.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I guess I do have a lot of fun asking the questions, not necessarily answering them. This is why I always am sitting there. Because I genuinely, I'm interested in the stories of people. Mm-hmm. This is how I connect to others. But on an occasion, I would be happy to do that.
Absolutely.
And, yeah, it would be great to have you as a host, actually.
Absolutely, sure, look forward to it.
Going to ask the smart questions. So next time we do it reverse.
The other way, absolutely. Thank you so much. Appreciate
thank
it.
You,
thank you.
Next on the Recursive Podcast, Bakhrom Ibragimov, partner at Molten Ventures.
Kind of really, we are.
What is your passion?
Yeah, we are right now in the vintage of AI adoption in terms of AI technology adoption. That's a vintage. It's you know, if we look at the global economy, is 100 trillion. I think the exact number is probably kind of 90, well, close number 93
but the
trillion.
AI is also a very broad definition.
Yes, but you know, what I wanted to say, what yeah. I want to say is that two-thirds of that global economy, mm-hmm. is sectors like healthcare, education, manufacturing, they've seen relatively low penetration of technology, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think the artificial intelligence is something that is actually, well, you know, driving the next stage of software growth, really digitalizing those sectors.
Okay, so this.
And if you're just as passionate about innovation as we are, hit subscribe for the Recursive Podcast on YouTube or your favorite podcast platform. We're everywhere.